orangutan would be a lot of fun. Living in the jungle away from everyone. Eating when I want and pooing where I please. What a life in the tropical tree.
And this is Steve Dale's Other World. And boy, this is a exciting moment for me. I am absolutely thrilled to talk again to Birute Mary Geldikas, who is one of the primatologists that Louis Leakey said, you're the one. You know the other two, perhaps. The Gorillas in the Myths lady, that's Diane Fossey, right? They made the movie, and she studied mountain gorillas for many, many years. And at the same time, Jane Goodall was studying chimpanzees. And you saw Jane Goodall, maybe recently, very recently, a movie came out from National Geographic. And she's been on National Geographic special after special after special after special. She tours all over, still all over America, talking about chimpanzees. But the woman that's often forgot about, there's a third. Her name is Birute Mary Geldikas. And she, Borneo, orangutans, the other great ape. Hello, Birute. It is so nice to talk to you again. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. And it's nice to talk to you. I mean, it's been, my gosh, since the late 80s, I think, is the last time that we maintained contact.
Yeah, somewhere in there. And I should explain. So you are the one that was in, and I'll let you further detail what I'm talking about, lived in Borneo for quite some time, studying the great ape. They're the big red great ape known as orangutans. And as a project that I did doing field research for you, I was then at the Lincoln Park Zoo, and a couple of us went to Borneo. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I would get up early in the morning. Most mornings, I would get up early in the morning. Orangutans, like all great apes, they go to bed in one particular place. They actually make a bed for themselves, in the case of orangutans, up in the tree. So you would go to that tree. I don't know how the guides found that tree to this day, but we'd go to that tree where we last saw the orangutans the night before, and we'd follow an orangutan, or sometimes a few of them, in the forest, and we'd write down what they ate, where what they did, where they went, the other orangutans that they associated with. We'd everything they did, we'd put down, literally, at that time, you'd write it out. How anyone would read my handwriting, I don't know. But we'd write it all out, and then at the end of the day, we'd come back, and the next day, do the same thing all over again. It was such a wonderful experience, and pretty much most, if not everything, we know about orangutans comes from the work that you did. So let me back up. Why orangutans? How did, I'm going back in time here, but how did you meet Louis Leakey? How was that choice made?
Well, I'm still in Borneo. I still spend over half the year there. I teach one semester a year. I'm a university professor. But ever since I was a little girl, I was curious. And what I was curious about was everything. But in particular, I was curious about humans. Where did we come from? Who were our ancestors? Did we have ancestors? And it was this curiosity that led me to orangutans. Orangutans were virtually unknown in terms of their ecology or their behavior in the wild. I mean, people basically knew nothing about them. They didn't even know whether they were solitary or social. And I think what intrigued me about orangutans, aside from this mystery about them, were their eyes. Even in pictures, if you look at them, they stare right at you. And their eyes also are not totally brown, like the African great ape eyes tend to be, but there's white around the iris of the orangutan eye. So there's something very uniquely human about them when you look into their eyes. And when you meet them in reality, when you meet them in real life, they also have that way of looking at you. And that gaze just penetrates right into your soul. So that's how I became curious about orangutans. And as I went to university that curiosity remained, and I wanted to go and study them for my PhD, for my doctoral research.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote people. I wrote the Malaysian government. I wrote people who had studied them in the past, and there were a few, because primatology was sort of beginning to wake up. And finally, I met Louis Leakey at a lecture when I was a graduate student at UCLA, and I went up to him after the lecture, after everybody else had left, more or less, and told him I wanted to study orangutans. And he looked at me. I'm sure he'd heard the story many times before. And when I told him that I had already written people in order to get my study off the ground, suddenly he got very interested, and he told me to stay in touch with him. He told me to write him in Africa. He said he was leaving for Kenya the next day, so he couldn't see me. And I said, well, give me an address. And he said, no, just write Louis Leakey, Africa. And
what?
It would get to him. And indeed, when I went to his office years later in Nairobi, he had envelopes posted on his wall that said exactly that, Louis Leakey, Olduvai Gorge, Africa. And that's what it had gotten to him.
Wow.
But then by the time I got home from UCLA, I was a graduate student at UCLA by this time, my mother was very excited, and she said, somebody called on behalf of Louis Leakey. You're supposed to meet him tomorrow. You're going to meet him tomorrow. And first of all, I was astonished that my mother knew exactly who Louis Leakey was. I didn't know she had any interest in human evolution per se, but that tells you how famous he was at the time.
Uh-huh.
And second, I was really pleased that Louis wanted to see me. So I went to see him the next morning, and he gave me a series of tests. And I passed those tests. I don't know if I passed them all, but I certainly passed some of them. And basically he told me that he didn't know for sure if I was the one, but he was interested in talking to me, but I already knew. I knew that he had chosen me to be the one person who would go out and study orangutans.
What kind of test? Was it a test about your knowledge of primatology? Or?
No. It was basically a test of acuity, perceptual acuity. So what he did is he had a deck of cards, and he put them on the table, you know, face down, and he said, which ones are red and which ones are black? And you know, I couldn't tell, but I noticed that he had bent one set, I don't know whether it was red or black, just a tiny bit. So half of them were bent, half of them were not. And I said, well, I don't know which is which, but I know that these must be one color and the other must be the other. And so he was so pleased. He was pleased as punch. I mean, he said that no man had ever given that test to had ever passed, but women did. And Jane had passed that test, Diane had passed that test, and I passed that test.
Huh.
And basically, he made up his mind when I asked him if he would help me study orangutans, that first moment or minute that he and I looked into each other's eyes when I went up to him after the lecture.
Did you know that this would be something that now, I don't know, I can't do math fast enough, but something like 40-plus years later, you're still in Borneo, you're still working, that this would be your life. You've written books about all this, incidentally, that this would be not only what you do, but as I said earlier, nearly everything we know about orangutans at some point goes back to you.
Well, that's who I am, and it's been almost 50 years now since I have been studying orangutans in Borneo, but over the years, the emphasis of my work has changed. It's that the wild orangutan study still continues. I have assistants, local assistants, who help me with my work. But orangutans are in dire danger of extinction. They're right on the precipice of the cliff. They fall down, they go extinct. Now, extinction is not necessarily of individuals. There will be individuals who may outlive extinction in the sense that they'll still be around, but that the wild orangutan populations that are biologically viable and can survive in perpetuity and can still undergo the effects of adaptation, evolution, in terms of their behavior, those will be gone. So biologically viable orangutan populations are virtually all on the edge of extinction.
And that's true for all of the species of orangutan?
Well, they claim there's three species. One was proclaimed last year. And, you know, when I went to Borneo to study orangutans in 1971, there was only one species of orangutan, and that was the orangutan.
Uh-huh.
But over the years, the orangutans were split into the Bornean species and the Sumatran species. And last year, 2017, taxonomists and others split the Sumatran species into two. So we are in an era of taxonomic inflation.
No, we are.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
It's just that I think as far as an orangutan is concerned, they don't recognize the three species. To them, an orangutan is an orangutan. And the reason I say this is because orangutans, Bornean and Sumatran orangutans, mate in captivity. The two Sumatran orangutans mate in captivity. So in the past, we probably didn't know that we were bringing back into captivity or into North America, wherever, Europe, two different species of Sumatran orangutans, and I'm sure that the orangutans didn't care either.
So here's how close to extinction are we talking? I mean, this species is so close to just disappearing, except in zoos. But as you say, the viable biological ability to genetically healthy continue is, we're seeing an end to that potentially. How close are we?
Well, we're very close. Orangutan populations can be wiped out in a matter of, I'd say even months, certainly a few years. And that is because they reproduce very slowly. An orangutan female in Borneo, where I study them, a female only gives birth to an infant once every 8 years. And even though orangutans are long-lived, still, because they start giving birth at about 16 or 17 years of age in the wild, this isn't true in captivity, but in the wild, and they do live into their late 40s and into their 50s, possibly into their 60s in the wild, on average, a female may only give birth, potentially, to four offspring in the course of her lifetime. And if the females are extirpated, in other words, if they're all killed in a population, the population can't bounce back like a population of rabbits can.
Yeah.
You have to wait 16 years for the infant orangutan female to reach a point of maturity where she can give birth. And in Sumatra, it's even worse. Females generally don't give birth until they're, you know, 16 or whatever, 17. But they don't wean their offspring until the offspring is 8 or 9 years. So often, an orangutan female can only have one infant every 10 years. And so if you figure it out, again, three or four offspring in the course of her lifetime. So you kill the females in an orangutan population, and you're done. I mean, that population is wiped out.
Well, no one, to my knowledge, is going into the forest and pointing guns so much at orangutans. That's not the issue, but there are issues. What are they?
Well, poaching is an issue.
Mm, really?
Tribal people in the interior of Borneo still kill and eat orangutans.
Really?
Yes, and but it's all related to the wholesale destruction of the tropical rainforest, both in Borneo and Sumatra. Orangutans are highly arboreal. They're huge. They're the largest arboreal animal on the planet. A big male can weigh 300 pounds. They're sexually dimorphic, so a female will probably only weigh 120 pounds. when she's mature. But if you cut down the forest, they eat mainly fruit, wild fruit that grows on trees. You're at risk of starving them to death. And the problem is the ubiquitousness of palm oil. Palm oil is in virtually all processed foods. They've estimated about 50% of all food, processed food in the supermarket, contains palm oil. I mean, sometimes even cereal contains palm oil because they add it to, you know, enrich the vitamin content, particularly vitamin A. So over the last 30 years, Borneo has been stripped of its forests. And when you travel through Borneo now, whether Indonesian Borneo or Malaysian Borneo, Sarawak and Sabah, something like miles and miles and miles, square, hundreds of square miles, thousands of square miles have been converted to palm oil, the palm oil plantations. And orangutans, about 85% of the original orangutan populations in the wild are gone in the last 25, 30 years, gone, gone with the wind.
Well, and I want to talk about this a little further. This isn't only a matter of one species, but when you fell the forest, when the forest no longer exists, and or a primary species like the orangutan disappear, we're talking about this impacting every other animal as well as other plants, plants that could be our pharmaceuticals, but also because we're talking about such a vast, vast amount of forest, as you mentioned, even impacts the weather in that part of the world, if not on the planet.
Oh, absolutely. And Borneo has had in the last few decades massive fires. In fact, one of those fires was the largest forest fire ever recorded in human history up to that time. I think since then there have been larger fires, but the fires spread through Borneo, Sumatra, and the smoke filled the skies over northern Australia into Malaysia. It was really astonishing. I mean, planes fell out of the sky because the smoke was so thick. I would be walking, and I could put my hand out in front of my face and not see my hand.
Wow.
It was just terrible. I mean, it was 10, 20 times worse than the worst smog I've ever experienced in Los Angeles, which was in the 1960s. And this burning, particularly of tropical peat swamp forests and the peat layers underneath, have caused Indonesia to be the third nation in terms, after China and the United States, in terms of emitting carbon into the world's atmosphere and therefore hastening global climate change. These fires, they were terrible fires in 2015, terrible fires in 2006, but the really bad ones were in 1997. And, you know, Julia Roberts actually came to do a documentary in July of 1997, and she came into Pangolin Boone in a billionaire's, Learjet or whatever, you know, private jet. And she left 3 weeks later in the last plane that left Pangolin Boone Airport for 3 months in a cargo plane, strapped to the metal benches on the side of a cargo plane because no commercial airlines were flying anymore. And certainly no billionaire was going to risk putting his, Learjet or whatever, Gulfstream jet, into Pangolin Boone. I mean, it was really, really bad. I mean, I know she felt very fortunate that she was actually able to leave Pangolin Boone in the smoke.
So does the government care that this... let me back up once. I'll ask it this way. In Rwanda, what that government has figured out is that protecting the mountain gorilla has actually, yes, it's benefited the mountain gorilla, but what's more important, perhaps, if I'm cynical, to them isn't protecting the mountain gorilla, but it's all the money that ecotourism has brought to Rwanda, changing in part. There are other reasons for it, but in part, that's one of the reasons why that government and that country is actually doing okay, if not thriving by any standards and certainly by African standards. Have you looked at the possibility of ecotourism, or, well, not you personally, but the government?
No, we've looked at it. We developed Camp Leakey as a tourist attraction. We put in feeding stations so orangutans come out of the forest to, you know, get some provisions, you know, to eat fruit that we provide them. And Camp Leakey and the surrounding national park, Tanjung Puting National Park, have become the number one tourist attraction for international tourists in the entire province of central Indonesian Borneo, or Kalimantan Tengah. So last year, we got over 15,000 tourists.
Wow.
Camp Leakey. So we've done everything that we can to welcome tourists as much as possible. But the problem overall is that Indonesia is a very, very wealthy country. You know, it was poor maybe in the 1960s and the 1950s, but it industrialized very quickly. Java has the most fertile soils in the world. You can triple crop a year on those volcanic soils in Java. So Indonesia is a very rich and prosperous country. Now, it was a member of OPEC. You know, it has gas and oil reserves, although the oil reserves are running out, but not the gas. It is the fourth largest country in terms of population on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
They have really pursued an educational path that means that very soon every single young person is going to have high school education. I mean, they've upped their literacy rates. Now, you know, there are poor people there, mainly farmers, but it's not a poor country in the absolute sense. I mean, it might be a poor country compared to Western nations, to Western democracies, but it's not poor. And so ecotourism is important. The Indonesian government has pushed tourism, and they try to also push ecotourism. But the problem is that in Borneo, you had vast forests, and it's not so much need that drives the palm oil industry in Indonesia and Malaysia and other places, even coming to Africa, it's greed. And of the top billionaires in Indonesia, and there are a number of them, virtually all of them either made their money initially in timber or in palm oil. The number one family in Indonesia owned the second largest palm oil plantations in the world. So palm oil has been very, very lucrative for the elites of Indonesia. And it's also lucrative for a middle-class business person who may have 50 hectares or 100 hectares of land under cultivation with palm oil. What it has not been lucrative for are the people, the laborers who work in palm oil.
Yeah.
And the small landholders who may have 2 to 5 hectares of palm oil. So it's, you know, I'd like to emphasize it's about greed. It's not about need. Although so many millions of people work in the palm oil industry that the Indonesian government does favor it, even though they have instituted various laws and regulations trying to discourage and prevent remaining primary rainforests in Borneo, for instance, from being demolished.
Well,
so there is an effort, but the problem is that the economic well-being of millions of Indonesians comes before the conservation well-being of tropical rainforests.
So on this side of the planet, thousands of miles away, you know, I've seen signs, don't buy products with palm oil. But as you point out, that's easier said than done. I mean, maybe that is the answer, maybe not. I mean, what do we do here?
Well, we try to make sure that any product that we buy is sustainable. Any product that has palm oil in it is sustainable. Well, what that basically means is that you can't buy anything with palm oil in it. If you care about orangutans, if you care about forests, if you care about ecology, if you care about global climate change, because there is virtually no sustainable palm oil for sale. And the irony is the only palm oil that I've ever heard of that is truly sustainable is actually in Ecuador.
Hmm.
And what's happened in Ecuador, I know that the local people have converted land that they've been farming for hundreds, if not thousands, of years from their traditional crops to their usual crops to palm oil. So no forest is demolished. Those forests were demolished thousands of years ago. It's like olive oil. Olive oil is sustainable because whatever, Spain, Italy, whatever, Portugal, those forests, Mediterranean-type forests that sustained wilderness were cut down thousands of years ago, maybe in pre-Roman times in Italy. So, when you buy olive oil, you don't have to worry about whether it's sustainable or not. It is.
And it's healthy.
It's really healthy. And that's the other thing about palm oil. It is not healthy. I mean, palm oil, there's all kinds of things. If you've had a heart attack, probably you could choose a better oil than palm oil. In fact, the first crusade, I don't want to use that word, the first sort of action against palm oil came years ago before we knew of the deleterious effects of palm oil on tropical rainforests and orangutans, when an American business person got a heart attack and he investigated what he was eating and he decided that one of the culprits was palm oil. So he led a campaign against palm oil for health reasons, not environmental reasons. And I remember seeing a commercial, I think it was the 1970s or 80s, it was probably the 80s, of, who is it, Bill Cosby? Cosby, the black comedian?
Yeah.
What is his name?
Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby, yes. And I remember seeing Bill Cosby, who was a spokesperson for, I don't know, Jell-O or Jell-O pudding.
That would be Bill Cosby.
Yeah, Bill Cosby. And he said, these Jell-O puddings don't contain tropical oils, as though tropical oils were some horrific thing. And the tropical oils that he was referring to was basically palm oil.
So what do we do? I'm unclear. So let's say people who are listening to this say, all right, I don't want orangutans to disappear from our planet. One thing I could do is not buy palm oil, but I don't know how to tell people to do that since palm oil is in so many products.
Well, you have to read labels. I mean, I started reading labels, and even though palm oil hides, camouflages itself, because there's at least 100 names for palm oil, but most of the time, in the United States at least, it does say palmate or palmite, or it has a palm in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it has that in it, then you think very carefully about whether or not you should buy it. And I don't buy it.
Well, of course not.
I mean, I just don't buy it. And when I started not buying it, when I started reading labels, I remember the first week or two, I lost 5 pounds.
Well, then I think we'll have a lot of people reading labels. If you can make that promise, I will begin reading labels. And I will anyway, because what you say is so incredibly compelling. So I have a different, because we only have a bit of time left, I have a couple of different questions to ask you. One is one of those questions you get asked all the time. Give me the craziest thing. So there you are. You're in the middle of the forest in Borneo, especially early on, kind of undeveloped, right? And what are one of the craziest things that ever happened to you having to do with orangutans?
Well, there's a lot of crazy things, but it's difficult to come up with one, but, I used to spend a lot of time following wild orangutans, and in order to go to their nests, like you did, their night nests, in the early morning before they woke up,
yep,
I would sit underneath their nest trees, and, and I'd be at their nest way before dawn, as you may recall.
Yes, I do. You'd set up a hammock. You gave us hammocks. Yeah.
One time, I'm sitting underneath a tree, and the local rubber tapper comes by, and they've got into the forest very early as well. And so I'm just sitting there in the middle of the swamp, and waiting for my orangutan that I'm following to wake up, and this rubber tapper passes by. Yeah, he's a few meters from me. He's not right on top of me. And, I'm polite. I have to. So I say, "Good morning, Pa." And my God, he jumped practically out of his skin, and he just raced away. And so what happened was, among the local people, and these are Malayu, they're not Dayaks, the story spread that there was a new ghost in the forest. And this new ghost was a white woman with long hair who walked accompanied by a host of orangutans. And I think what happened is people saw me in the forest, and I didn't see them, but they'd run away. And so when my then-husband, Rod Brindamore, went to the eastern side of what was then Tanjung Puting Reserve, he also heard the story of the new ghost in the forest and was asked, had he seen the new ghost in the forest? Now, it's highly unlikely that the people on the eastern side of the what was then the reserve, which was 40, 50 kilometers, impenetrable rainforest, had actually seen me, but the myth had spread.
That is very – I've not heard that story before. For me – it was getting there early one morning, and I mean, this kind of thing you hear all the time, but I was in the hammock waiting for the orangutan that we were following to get up in the morning. And the orangutan was up, but I had fallen asleep. So it's as if the orangutan wanted to wake me up. So the orangutan from way up in the trees with very good aim urinates right on me, which woke me up. And I was told then by my guide that the orangutan certainly knew who I was. I don't know if that was a compliment or not. I'm thinking maybe not.
Because the orangutan had seen you before? Had
yes.
Had you followed him or her
yes.
before?
Yes, yes,
oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
The orangutan knew who you were because in those days, in the late 80s, when you were there, the tourism hadn't yet started. The tourism started in the 1990s. And so when you were there, the only people that ever came by most of the time were the Earthwatch volunteers.
Yeah, that was, yeah, yep, that was me.
In fact, it was that built up the tourism industry. And it was that caused local people to realize that if tourists came, they could rent out their boats that they were using for dragging logs, but it would be, more profitable to use the boats for tourism. And gradually, the tourism arose, and part of it was because I used to give a lot of talks in North America and even in Europe, and occasionally in Japan, very occasionally in Australia, and I promoted Tanjung Puting, and I promoted orangutans, and I said, if you want to help the great apes, the best thing that you can do is visit the habitat countries. Go see them. Show with your dollars that you care about orangutans, you care about tropical rainforests. And I think it led to more people coming, and then, of course, it had sort of a cascading effect. The National Geographic articles, both of which I wrote and were cover articles, had a great effect. All the television films that were made. I mean, I've estimated that there have been at least 100 film crews or television crews. I mean, some of them were just one person, some guy from Austrian News, came to camp and stayed for 2 days. But, there was an IMAX really helped because it was an IMAX film called Born to be Wild that was actually shown in theaters, and it's still being shown in museum IMAX theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And all that publicity, all that, and then, of course, the Indonesian government also promoted it, led to people coming to see orangutans in Borneo and Sumatra as well. So,
in a way, though, to me, we're killing ourselves
killing ourselves?
Yeah, here's
what... We are. Yeah. We absolutely are.
Yeah, I don't even have to explain what I mean to you, but here's an animal that is kind of... I mean, it's us. They are... I don't know. You can give me the percent, but something like 98% of our genetics. And you're right. So one morning, or 2 days in a row, I think my job, I had gotten ill there, and I remember you came into where we slept, and you said, "Are you feeling better, Steve?" I said, "Not so much." And you said, "Do you have any antibiotics with you?" And I don't remember if I did or you gave them to me. And you said, "Well, I hope you do get better because the closest doctor is a specialist. He's really good. He does one thing, amputations." And that motivated me to get better really fast. But my job was for a couple of days. My job is true. What I just said, I remember. But my job for a couple of days was to babysit these orphan orangutans. And when you hold one of these babies, it is. You see the whites of their eyes, but you see their eyes. You see their soul. And it isn't all too different. Look at an orangutan face, especially a baby. And a human baby, they're so much the same. They are, as I suggested, nearly the same genetically. That's what I mean that we're killing ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. And what we're doing with global climate change, what we're doing with pollution all over the earth. There are some countries where longevity is declining, especially in among men. And I cite Russia as one of those countries. But, you know, one of the things that we've done is we had training courses for, as volunteers, I mean, I don't get paid, but training courses for palm oil company managers. And I remember one of the things that we do is we invite them to the care center. And I remember a man, you know, a palm oil manager who manages hundreds of, not thousands of hectares of palm oil. He's holding an orangutan infant in his arms, and that's what he said. He said, almost tears came to his eyes. He said, "This is exactly like holding my baby daughter," he said.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely right. They share 97% of their genetic material with us, and because in the wild they tend to be solitary or semi-solitary, when you meet an orangutan, you don't really have a species barrier. Gorillas and chimpanzees are very social. You know, they know that they're gorillas and chimpanzees. Orangutans obviously know they're orangutans, but they live muchly alone. So when you interact with an orangutan, it's just one individual interacting with another, and the species isn't that important to them. So you can really get very close to an orangutan in an emotional way that perhaps is difficult with some other animals, some other species of primates.
Well, the good news, I think, is that people who worked with you at some point, and you know I know a few of them, their lives changed after their experience with you. You impacted a whole lot of people. You've impacted an entire species, thousands of people, bigger than the species, to be aware of all sorts of ecological issues, including the palm oil issue that we talked about. I mean, people may know Diane Fossey, as I said, from the movie Gorillas in the Mist. They may know Jane Goodall, Dr. Goodall, from all the work that she's done, as they should know about Dr. Goodall, who I've spoken to many times, from the amazing work that she's done with chimpanzees, but a bit higher profile than the work you've done, which is no different with orangutans, perhaps because it's further away, because perhaps orangutans are perceived as being a bit more different. Maybe it's because they aren't social animals like chimpanzees are or gorillas are. Or maybe it's the way National Geographic marketed the whole thing all those years ago. But your work is no less important. And I thank you for connecting me with you again. It's been great talking to you. I can't let you go without mentioning this. You are now president, and have been, of Orangutan Foundation International. And by going to that website, you can find out more about orangutans, but more importantly, ways in which you can help Dr. Galdikas and your work and help protect these animals before they disappear. And as you point out, there may not be much time left But I assume you'd agree there's still some hope.
Of course there's hope. As long as there's one tree standing in the forests of Borneo, and as long as there's, you know, one orangutan, at least two, you know, roaming the mountains and swamps of Borneo, we still have hope. And we are now working in the largest wild orangutan population in the world, which is Tanjung Puting. And there's only one reason that it is the largest population in the world, and that's because we, and I don't just mean myself, but my assistants, my students, my associates, have been there now for almost 50 years. And just by being there and fighting to protect the forest, we basically have saved that population from extinction.
And just because we're out of time, and maybe another time we could talk about it, I know that there were cases where you literally fought to protect the, I mean, literally fought to protect the forest. There are books about it. Google, you can read the books. I'm in one of those books, actually. I'm mentioned in one of your books. That's a thrill for me. Dr. Geldikas, thank you so very much, and I hope people do go to the Orangutan Foundation International to learn more. Thank you.
Thank you.